This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. Big news on the state's reopening plan today. Governor Charlie Baker said this afternoon that beginning on Monday, indoor performance venues will be able to open at lower capacity, but to be followed later by stadiums like Gillette and Fenway Park. And we will get to all of that in a minute, but first we want to cover what Governor Baker said this morning at a sometimes tense oversight hearing about the governor's handling of the vaccine rollout. The hearing actually is still underway. WBUR Senior State House reporter Steve Brown has been monitoring it. Steve took a pause to join us. Hi there, Steve.
Hi, Tiziana.
So, Steve, this is the first time that the governor's appeared at an oversight hearing to answer questions about his handling since the beginning of the pandemic. We have talked on air before about the fact that until now, the legislature has been pretty passive, pretty deferential, letting Baker take the lead, not pushing back, for example, on emergency powers. What about today? How would you characterize the tone of today's hearing?
Well, the governor tried to set the tone from the get-go, focusing not on the problems with the website, but instead highlighting numbers showing that per capita Massachusetts is actually doing pretty well. Number one for first doses administered per capita in states with 5 million people or more. Number eight for the first doses per capita nationwide. He read all those numbers off, but the legislators just weren't buying it, especially after today they received another round of calls from ticked-off constituents. Spent more than an hour or so on that website this morning, only to see wait time estimates jump from just a few minutes in some cases to tens of thousands of minutes, and then eventually getting kicked off the site with no appointment in hand. Arlington State Senator Cindy Friedman started pushing back on the governor's characterization of the vaccine rollout. Let's listen.
But now we come to the vaccine rollout, and frankly, I am just baffled at what we've been through. And my experience of this is very different than the one you've laid out. The twists and turns, the change in plans, the communication that changes depending on who you are talking to and from day to day. I can say, as someone who has been involved in this process and deeply involved since last March, that even I, with all my knowledge, am completely at a loss as to what is going on at times and what is going to come next.
Yeah, Steve, so that is really pointed criticism. What did the governor say?
Yeah, he tried to deflect by saying that the main problem is the fact that the state is only getting 135,000 doses per week, and we need a lot more than that to meet the demand. He says everyone acknowledges the anxiety and frustration that comes with people being unable to access an appointment or a chance to get a vaccination when their time comes because of issues around supply.
Okay, so sharp words there from State Senator Friedman. I gather she wasn't the only one who was sharp. Did others push back on the governor?
They did, especially Senator Eric Lesser, who called the vaccine appointment rollout a failure. I want to play a portion of an exchange between Lesser and the governor. Lesser was really trying to pin the governor down about why the vaccine sign-up website crashed last week.
You said on February 17th that 1 million new people would be eligible. You were also then asked directly, will the website be ready? And you said, quote, it would be in, quote, good shape. Did you do a load analysis with your team, or did you ask your tech provider whether a load analysis had been done on 1 million new people being eligible?
What happened to the websites on us? I was incredibly
will you say sorry
upset
to the,
by it
will
when
you
it
say
happened.
Sorry to the 1 million people?
Of course. Absolutely. Definitely. Yes, of course. And it's going to be a constant challenge going forward that we don't have enough supply to serve the population that wants to get vaccinated. I hope at some point that's not true anymore.
And that was Baker's common theme. The tech problems were regrettable, but the real limiting factor here is the supply of vaccine.
So, Steve, you talked a minute ago about the fact that there are new reports circulating this morning of people getting these massive wait times in this new waiting room that you go into first on the website, you know, tens of thousands of minutes after this 50,000 new appointments became available. And it made me think about the difference between fixing something and actually making it better. So fixing the site didn't crash today like it did last week, but that doesn't seem any better in terms of a user experience. Did you get the sense today that the administration understands how bad constituents are consistently finding the experience of trying to get scheduled to vaccinate?
Yeah, I think they are understanding the frustration that people are having. But they point back to that limited supply, saying until that significantly increases, there will be more people wanting the vaccine than getting it. The governor says they'll continue to make improvements to the website. But, of course, he said that last week as well. And a lot of people were left out in the cold this morning.
So, Steve, we've done a lot of coverage together over the last year. You've been following the governor on this. I think his press conferences began daily March a year ago, so almost exactly a year ago. What did you expect to see in the exchanges between he and the oversight panel today? And did you see what you expected?
I did. You know, a lot of the things he said he has been saying for the past couple of weeks always goes back to that supply. And it's true. You know, you got 4 million people that need to get vaccinated. Obviously, right now, there are a million that are eligible. But you've only got this limited supply. But what the legislature is pushing back is, hey, you know, the website has nothing to do with the supply. Yes, you know, it's like a game of musical chairs here that, you know, you've only got so many vaccines, so many chairs, and when the music stops, you've got 900,000 people still standing and only 50,000 were able to get appointments.
So what are you watching for next? Whether I think Secretary Mary Lou Sutter still is yet to testify today. So what are you watching for next today and in the coming days now that we've had this change in tone here with the legislature and the administration?
Yeah, I think Secretary Sutter's and DPH Commissioner Monica Burrell will be kind of batting cleanup for the administration. They believe are slated for 4 o'clock today. And I imagine that they will be filling in some more of the details and also, you know, pushing the administration's position that, you know, despite the problems, things are going well. In the future, I'll be watching for the production of the vaccine to increase, as is everyone. So therefore, they'll be able to make more appointments. That will take the pressure off the weekly mad rush for vaccine. Of course, the legislature is keeping an eye on all of this as well. And the House chairman of the committee said that they're going to be having another hearing in 2 weeks. And he invited the governor to attend. The governor responded somewhat facetiously that this one had been so much fun, he certainly looks forward to coming back.
All right. Well, that I am going to watch for. That is WBUR Senior Statehouse reporter Steve Brown. Steve, thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So, as we said, it wasn't the only news coming from Governor Baker today. Testimony regarding the vaccine was this morning, but then just a couple of hours ago, the governor announced that as of Monday, Massachusetts is going to enter step two of phase three of the reopening plan. We'll tell you what that is. And then on March 22nd, we're going to officially enter for the first time phase four. So what does all of that mean? Here to help us is WBUR's Quincy Walters. Hey there, Quincy.
Hey, Tiziana.
Thanks for doing this. So let's lay it out for folks. Let's start with next Monday. That is step two of phase three. So what does that mean?
Yeah, so I'll just start by saying this is sort of a constellation of dizzying numbers. But this means that indoor performance venues can open at 50% capacity with up to 500 people. It also means that indoor recreational activities like laser tag or roller skating and places where, you know, the walls and floors are trampolines can open to 50% capacity. Fitting rooms can open. And this all might be, you know, perfect timing because the forecast is calling for rain on Monday.
Okay. And again, for listeners, that's Monday. Okay. Now, the governor also said that some of the restrictions Monday on restaurants would be loosened, right?
Yeah. So the restrictions that were put on restaurants in December following that surge have been lifted. There's no percentage limit, but there are sort of, you know, numerical parameters that restaurants have to follow. Tables have to be 6 feet apart. There can be no more than six people at each table, and those patrons can't stay any longer than 90 minutes. But it does not apply to food courts, which are still closed.
Okay, so then there were announcements about phase four. Now, that will happen on March 22nd, as long as there are no significant changes in the public health data, obviously, between now and then. That'll be our first time moving into phase four. What will we do then? What happens?
So, Tiziana, in a word, Fenway, but
Fenway.
there will be more words. This will allow stadiums and arenas like Fenway and Gillette and the Garden, places with, 5,000 seat capacity, they can open, but at 12%. And this also includes summer camps, and it might be too cold to be thinking about that, which means it might be the perfect time to be thinking about that. But overnight summer camps are allowed to reopen. And this also includes exhibition and convention halls. But, if you were looking forward to, getting your groove on somewhere, nightclubs are not open. Dance floors can only happen at weddings.
Oh, there are so many things I'm looking forward to, Quincy. Getting my groove on is one. That does sound like that's going to have to wait. So what else is going to have to wait? What's not going to get to reopen for step one of phase four, which is the part that would hopefully be scheduled to start on March 22nd?
Yeah, so the businesses that are still on sort of standby are bars and clubs, amusement parks, indoor water parks, parades, all have to wait until sort of, the governor said, until, data lend itself to their reopening.
So kind of whiplash here, Quincy, and I suspect intentional whiplash, right? Because pushback on how the vaccine rollout is going this morning, and then, hey, lots of stuff. An announcement comes from the governor who got pushback. Lots of stuff opening this afternoon. What are you hearing in reaction to these reopening announcements?
Right. So, there's been no sort of explicit correlation between, the hearing today and the reopening. And at the press conference, the governor sort of, tried to make the case for his decisions by saying that his handling of the pandemic has, been in the best interest of the Commonwealth. And he's been, every decision he makes has been met with people saying he's been too lax or he's been too cautious. This is sort of an attempt to get businesses back that, he's followed what's happened in other states that have made similar decisions and have fared okay. So this is, him hoping to get Massachusetts, as he said a couple of times, to the other side.
All right, that's WBUR's Quincy Walters. Quincy, thanks.
Thanks, Tiziana.
There's no question that our faith in our institutions has been tested in the last year. Think about it. The federal government's initial handling of the coronavirus pandemic, rifts between police and communities of color, former President Trump challenging the 2020 elections, his supporters storming the Capitol, the Senate acquitting him in this month's impeachment trial. But we have struggled with faith in our institutions for decades now. It's been a long time, and we've seen a number of new social movements arise in response. Think Occupy Wall Street, Tea Party, hashtag Me Too, Black Lives Matter, to name a few. Well, UMass Amherst Associate Professor Ethan Zuckerman argues that mistrust can lead to fundamental changes that help improve our institutions, but it can also make fertile ground for authoritarianism. And he explores these points in a new book, Mistrust: Why Losing Faith in Institutions Provides the Tools to Transform Them. He joins us now. Ethan, welcome to Radio Boston.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Tiziana. Thanks for having me.
I am excited to kind of roll our sleeves up on this. As I get started, Ethan, I do want to invite our listeners to join us. So listeners, for you, how much faith do you have in institutions today, especially governmental institutions, not just, but especially? And what happens when citizens don't trust their government, be it for good reasons or bad reasons? Do you see that as fertile ground for change? Do you see it as destabilizing? How are you thinking about it? I know it's a big question, but engage with us. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or we're watching the Twitters. You can tweet at us at Radio Boston. So, all right, Ethan, so I'm reading your book in early January and thinking, holy cow, this is this book that talks about insurrection and mistrust in institutions. And we had just had January 6th happen. Did you think you were being that prescient when you wrote the book?
You know, as you know, you never get the choice for when these books come out. And in fact, I've been working on this book for 7 years. I actually started researching the rise of mistrust before Donald Trump really returned as a political force. So I had no advance foreknowledge of what happened on January 6th. In fact, in some ways, what happened late in the Trump presidency, as he got so good at weaponizing mistrust and using mistrust in institutions of all sorts to bring people out into the streets, that was something I really hadn't anticipated in the book. But I think there's a lot of the deep history, the ways in which Americans have lost trust in institutions, really from the 1970s to today, that helped set the stage for the really unique past 4 years that we've just lived through.
All right, so there's a lot there that I want to unpack. Before I do also want to say that as I was reading your book in January, it made me really uncomfortable because there was a tone, at least in parts of it, really demonstrating a history of insurrection as a generative and positive thing. That is not what we saw on January 6th.
No, absolutely not. And we should be very clear about that. The term insurrectionist is one that I borrowed from Chris Hayes, the MSNBC commentator. And he, about 10 years ago, wrote a book where he drew a really helpful distinction. He said that you can't just think about U.S. politics in terms of left and right anymore. You have to think also in terms of institutionalist and insurrectionist. And what he meant by those terms and what I meant by those terms were people who believe in making change either from working within an institution or people who believe that sometimes those institutions are no longer fit for purpose. And that what we have to do is think about how to replace them with a different and a better institution. I think what happened on January 6th actually doesn't have a lot of continuum with those ideas. I think what happened in January 6th is really much more understood as terrorism. It's the use of violent force as a way to keep someone who is in power already in power. I actually think that the way in which I'm using the term insurrectionism does a much better job of applying to movements that we saw a lot of this past summer, the Black Lives Matter movement, and particularly the Defund the Police movement. So what I'm arguing to take seriously are movements that essentially say, look, in some communities of color, trust in policing is so low, and for such good reasons is so low, that we actually have to think about not just reforming that institution, but coming up with an entirely new institution so that we have the possibility of an institution the public trusts and is willing to interact with. So that's the idea that I was trying to put forward. I think maybe subtext in all of this is just that high levels of mistrust are incredibly dangerous. And I think that's in part what I take out of the January 6th movement.
Okay, but that would also mean, if I'm hearing you correctly, that you would essentially fundamentally reject attempts to draw parallels, constructs between, for example, Black Lives Matter protests and demonstrations over the summer and what we saw at the Capitol on January 6th. I want to parse that out.
I think we want to be very careful about making comparisons between the two, because I think what happened on January 6th has to do with weaponization of mistrust. I think something that has happened, something that's happened a great deal in the Trump presidency is something that we really haven't seen coming out of the White House before. People have run for political office for years as outsiders, but we've really never seen someone take the presidency and then announce, actually, you can't trust anyone, and you can't even trust the government that I'm in charge of, right? Donald Trump did something really unique in sort of positing this notion of a deep state, positing this notion that the FBI was against him, maybe the Department of Justice was against him, that there was a permanent class of bureaucrats fighting against him, and essentially arguing that you couldn't trust the media, you couldn't trust the government, you could only trust him. And based on that sort of weaponization of mistrust, taking mistrust that his supporters already had in the media, already had in bureaucratic institutions, and sort of channeling it into this sort of cult of the individual, the cult of personality, I think that's very, very different than what's gone on in communities of color, where there's a real, genuine history of violence between the police and between over-policed Black communities. So I'm very reluctant to draw a line from one to the next, but that is part of what's so complex about this moment. There is an aspect of mistrust in social systems and institutions that you can find at the heart of the far right, as well as at the heart of movements coming from the left.
All right, so let's use that as an opportunity to kind of widen our aperture away from just January 6th. Sure. And as we do that, I do want to invite our listeners again, 800-423-8255, to participate in this conversation as you're hearing Ethan's arguments unfold, weaponizing of mistrust, institutionalists versus insurrectionists. Let's ask you, how much faith do you have in institutions today? Are they transformable from within? Or is it time to dispose of some of our institutions and replace them? How are you thinking about that? Again, 800-423-8255. So, Ethan, let's talk a little bit more about insurrectionist versus institutionalist.
Sure.
Both of those sound to me, and in the book as I read it, I saw it, and this might just be my own mental lens, as a belief that institutions matter, right? But
sure.
Sometimes they fail, but it's not we should get rid of institutions. It is sometimes we need to replace institutions. And I think we're seeing some public discourse about that around the entire pandemic and vaccine rollout. So maybe explain that out for us a little more.
Sure. We're now facing the moment where the global pandemic sort of came to our attention roughly a year ago. I was actually looking through my emails today. The first email I got from a colleague when I was at MIT telling us to take the pandemic seriously came out a year ago today. And I think one of the things that we found in this intervening year are that a lot of institutions that we would have really hoped would step up and tell us what to do, what not to do, how to get the vaccine, what precautions to take, did not function nearly as well as we might have expected. We got much less leadership on the federal level than we would have hoped for. State governments have really gone back and forth. Here in the Northeast, we've actually had governments that have been reasonably responsible, but in many parts of the country, we've had governments that are very concerned about shutting down. One of the things that I was reflecting on was that the first institution that actually told me, take coronavirus seriously and please stop traveling, please stop coming into work, was my employer. It was MIT. It wasn't the state. It wasn't the federal government. At the same time, I think this
it was
is
your
incredible...
I just want to clarify, that was your employer then, right? You were not at MIT.
That was my employer then. I'm now at UMass Amherst, which is also doing a good job tackling the disease. But I thought it was really interesting that for many people, employers were the institutions that were sort of making that decision about the coronavirus, in part because state and federal institutions were significantly slower to act. I think at moments of crisis, we often find ourselves looking for an institutional voice to tell us what to do, in part because it's hard to make those decisions by ourselves. We all have different sensitivities to risk. We didn't know as much about the disease now as we did then. We want an institution to step up and tell us what to do in
many
cases.
Isn't it also sort of a prisoner's dilemma? Meaning we rely on institutions because institutions are how we behave collectively. And surviving this pandemic, avoiding spread, et cetera, required collective behavior as well as individual behavior.
And we've seen the nations that have done the most impressive job holding back coronavirus have had collective behavior in really interesting ways. I've been watching the government of Taiwan, which I write about quite a bit in the book, because it's a very new government. It's a government that came into power in 2014 after a very thorough revolution in the country. And it's a government that has opened up a whole lot of digital channels. So it hears an enormous amount from the population. And we saw that play through even in coronavirus. We actually saw the Taiwanese government relying on citizen-built services to help people find masks in pharmacies. So a citizen put together a tool to let people find masks. The government saw it and said, this is great. Let us scale it up for you. And then use that as a way to get towards universal mask wearing. And governments like Taiwan and like New Zealand are seeing enormous rises in trust, even at a moment when many other governments are experiencing a real drop in trust.
So there's a lot more I'm sure we could discuss there. I do want to note, I imagine that there would be folks who would want to debate whether the Taiwanese government and that model of government would work here, is what we want to emulate here. But I see your point about the level of trust between the institution and the citizens. I do want to turn to the phones here, 800-423-8255, because we've got Mike on the line, and I want to hear what Mike wants to add to the conversation. Mike in Everett, go ahead.
So I'm not really sure if you consider it an institution. It's kind of a new one, which is basically social media. And I really feel like it is what is causing a lot of our differences of opinion. When they will look at, they have algorithms that look at who you are, and they say, oh, you're conservative, we're going to give you this information. And then the same search.
So, Mike, your sound is cutting out. So I apologize, Mike. I think you had more to say, but your sound is cutting out. However, you've given us a good jumping off point there. And Ethan, I think maybe that even ties back to your noting that for the first time in the last 4 years, we had a president who was able to weaponize mistrust. So maybe you can put those pieces together for us.
Sure. There's been a debate for many, many years about whether social media is weakening our public character. Is it putting us into echo chambers? Is it polarizing us more? One of the reasons I wanted to look at some of the real history of the rise of mistrust is that it turns out that our falling trust in government way precedes social media. If we go back in history, if we ask people the question, do you trust government to do the right thing all or most of the time, that number peaks in 1964 at 77%. By 1980, it's fallen to 26%. So there's this enormous slide that happens in the 1970s at a point where the internet is something that's only in research labs. So if we're going to blame it on something, we probably can't blame it exclusively on the internet. In fact, there's better explanations, I think, like rising inequality, like the actual failure of institutions. I think those end up tracking much better. However, I do think social media and the spread of mis and disinformation has made it easier to weaponize mistrust. I think it's made it much easier to say, you don't trust the government, you shouldn't trust the government, they're lying to you, and here's what you should do as a result. Now, I think the problem with blaming social media exclusively is that it leaves out a critical piece of this, which is that some of these mistrustful strategies have just become part of politics. We just went through an experience where the majority of Republicans elected at the federal level ended up supporting an entirely bogus challenge to an election. You can't deal with that sort of mistrust, essentially one party embracing the belief that an election was rigged when in fact it wasn't. You can't deal with that purely as an informational problem. Just fixing Facebook is not going to solve that problem. We actually have to go and fix politics. At the same time, fixing Facebook wouldn't be a bad idea. Putting enormous amounts of control over who gets and who doesn't get to speak in the hands of whether it's Mark Zuckerberg or Jack Dorsey is not a particularly wise way forward. So I think social media is absolutely an institution. It's one we should monitor closely, but it can't be the only cause of this problem.
Okay, so in our time remaining, let's have you hold up another example. You talked about the Taiwanese government and their back and forth and flow of information with their citizens. A reformed institution, or where insurrection in the way you're using it led to a healthier institution. Give us yet, you know, in a few sentences, give us one more example.
Sure. I would say that the Me Too movement is actually a very successful example of insurrection. And this is a belief that the way that workplaces are handling sexual harassment, where it's about being silent, it's about being quiet, having a legal process behind the scenes, is not working well for the victims of sexual harassment. And that actually having a process that is much more public, that is much more visible, that is encouraging victims to speak out, I think that is a major shift in norms. One of the big things that I talk about in the book is that people who feel frustrated about making social change through changing laws have other options. They can try to make change in markets. They can try to make change through code and technology. But maybe the most powerful weapon is by changing norms. Me Too has been a norms-based movement that tries to change the rules over how we talk about sexual harassment and sexual assault. And it's had an enormous impact on workplace culture and made it possible for more people to speak out about the experiences they've had.
All right. That is one of the case studies in Mistrust, Why Losing Faith in Institutions Provides the Tools to Transform Them. The book is by Ethan Zuckerman, associate professor at UMass Amherst. Ethan, really thought-provoking. Thanks for the time today.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm so glad we get to talk now about this new film, Judas and the Black Messiah. I think it's really interesting coming off the conversation we had before the break with Ethan Zuckerman about insurrections, institutions, what happens, how people push when they experience mistrust in government or the failure of other bodies that are responsible for the social contract. Judas and the Black Messiah retells the story of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, its chairman, Fred Hampton. Fred Hampton is played by Daniel Kaluuya. The film depicts the assassination of Hampton, orchestrated by the FBI with the help of an informant. The informant's name was William O'Neill. He's played by Lakeith Stanfield. We're going to talk about what stood out about that movie and how it lays out a microcosm of what we were discussing before with insurrection and institutions, with the Black Panthers as the case example. We're going to invite you to be a part of that conversation again. 800-423-8255. Did you see the film? Do you know the history of Fred Hampton? Were you taught about the Black Panthers? What resonates about any of it for you today, and what's the legacy of how we challenge authority, especially as we grew in our mistrust in institutions in the 60s and 70s? 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us for the conversation, Michael Jeffries, who is the Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley College. Michael, welcome back. I'm so excited to talk with you.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited too.
All right. So, Michael, I'm going to start by saying I did a whole lot of framing there. I should give you a chance to say whether you agree with that framing or you think I'm wrong.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting question to frame the Panthers as an insurrectionist group, because when you look at their founding and especially some of their initial reasons for forming the organization, they're really well within the bounds of the law and their right to defend themselves. And that's really why the Black Panthers started all of their activities. They were tired of the constant police violence that they were subjected to in Oakland, California, and around the country. And we're really trying to carve out space to live a life of dignity, a life free from poverty, and to maintain the right to protect themselves. That's a little bit different, I think, from the classic definition of insurrection, though many of the issues pertaining to justice and state institutions are certainly applicable.
Would you say that in this film, Judas and the Black Panther, and Judas and the Black Messiah, not Judas and the Black Panthers, would you say that this film paints Fred Hampton as a revolutionary and a positive revolutionary?
Yes, absolutely. It's a really interesting film because it is not a complete biography of Hampton. It really tells the story of the moment, 1968, 1969, and the kind of dual lives of Fred Hampton and the FBI informant, William O'Neill, who ultimately conspires in a way that leads to Hampton's death. So it's more of a snapshot of that moment and that relationship, because O'Neill was inside the party, working very closely with Hampton and ultimately betraying him. It's not a full-fledged biography, but what it does, especially in some of the early portions of the film, is makes it clear where Hampton stood and the position of the Black Panther Party relative to some of the other organizations organizations that we know from the history of the civil rights movement in this country. And some of the ideological pieces that were introduced to make it quite clear that he is a revolutionary. He describes himself that way in the film. He challenges the logic of slow reform. He challenges other revolutionary logics, like Pan-Africanism, for example, comes under a bit of criticism from Hampton in the film as well. But there's no doubt he's a revolutionary because he embraces economic policies and political policies that are far outside the American mainstream and necessary for the survival of Black Americans in our country.
We've got calls coming in. Are you ready to go to the phones?
Sure.
All right, let's do it. 800-423-8255. We've got Donna on the line from Brockton. Donna, go ahead.
Hi, yes. I was just going to add that this is something that's not taught in high schools or middle school history class, and I think it's very important considering the next few years, 4 years, there's going to be teenagers now who are going to be voting. And I think we, as we talk about the political system and institutions in the last segment, and how we talk about how we're going to basically change things, I think we need to start with the teachers. They make a way bigger impact than we obviously give them credit for, and that's said all the time. And we need to change the education system, including the history books, that talk about these things. I'm 28 years old. I never heard of the Black Panther Party at school. I don't know who Fred Hampton is. I am going to watch the movie, and I think that should speak for itself.
Thanks, Donna. I appreciate that. And I'm going to add one more call here, Michael, because Brian's on the line from Northborough, and Brian's a history teacher. So, Brian, jump in.
Hey, good afternoon, folks. Thanks for taking my call. I'll keep it pretty quick. My wife and I attended the opening showing in our local theater a few weeks ago. I was very excited for this movie. I did a tremendous job, I think, telling this story historically accurately in a way that everybody should understand. The biggest takeaway I had, and I was curious your thoughts on it, was the FBI's involvement at such a high level, the federal government all the way down to the assassination of Fred Hampton. I think it's a really illustrative example of the ingrained racism that we deal with every day, have dealt with since our inception. And maybe part of the reason it's such a difficult hurdle to overcome today, that was just what I took away from it, was that federal government involvement. I just wanted your thoughts.
Thanks for that, Brian. Michael, go ahead.
Yeah, I'll try to take both questions and start with the second question first. I mean, that is one of the things that the film does an incredible job of showing, is how committed the FBI is to disrupting the Black Panther Party, and what a political priority it was for the FBI and the United States federal government. And this is not a surprise when you look at the history of the FBI. I mean, the history of disruption and surveillance when it comes to the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X or Martin Luther King and his colleagues. So it fits right in the tradition of that time with respect to the energy and the intensity with which the FBI approached the civil rights as civil rights movement as a national security issue. On the education piece, I think it's a great point, because one of the initial priorities of the Black Panther Party when they were founded was education. The education of Black folks in particular, because the founders, Bobby Seale, Huey Newton, understood that they couldn't really carve out a path to revolution without self-knowledge first. And it's important that we see that emphasis in education reflected not only in other movements that would advance similar goals, but also in our national program of education, because if we're going to learn from this and really leverage the successes, and there are so many successes of this movement, the commitment to public health, for example, the free breakfast program, for example, that have been co-opted in some ways by government institutions, we have to really understand the educational piece, and we can't avoid looking at the severe criticisms and whitewash the history.
So that's interesting. And I think it goes back to our first caller too. Producer Paris Alston and I were talking this morning as we were getting ready to speak with you. And we were talking about the fact that this is a movie that tells this story and tells it in a way that probably wouldn't have even gotten made 5 years ago. Especially the level of criticism about the government and this the presentation of the way in which the Black Panthers in Chicago were fulfilling pieces of the social contract, like the breakfast program. What, I mean, at one level, this seems obvious, but let's engage with it. What has changed that this is the story we're telling this way for the first time, really, now?
Yeah, it's a good point. I mean, I think the obvious answer here is the Black Lives Matter movement and the recognition that if we don't uproot these problems, which are historically rooted problems, and understand them in all of their historical complexity and rootedness, we're never really going to get to a place where we have justice in America. So I think that the Black Lives Matter movement continues to lay bare some of the disparities, inequities, and injustices. And that kind of laid the ground, seeded the ground for projects like this to maybe reach audiences that they hadn't before. And still, right, if you watch this film and you know a little bit more about the history, you're going to feel like this is just a very small appetizer to what is a much deeper and longer story of the Black Panther Party. I mean, you get some of the history of the party and their accomplishments and priorities in the movie, but really it's a movie about these two central characters. So one of my great hopes is that people, of course, relish the performances of Sandfield and Kaluuya, but that they take this opportunity to find out more. And I know that the producers of the film have produced materials and other such things that will encourage that educational piece just as much as the entertainment piece.
And I do want to stay with the educational piece, but I also do want to underscore what you just said, which is the performances by Kaluuya and Lakeith Stanfield are incredible, as is the performance by Dominique Fishback, who plays Deborah Johnson, now known as Akua Njeri, who was Fred Hampton's then fiance. So there is a huge entertainment dimension to this film as well, but there's a lot that we learn. And Michael, one of the things that really struck me is the way the film tells of how Hampton built coalitions. So it depicts the Rainbow Coalition. Specifically, the film features the Young Patriots, who were white, the Young Lords, who were Puerto Rican, and then they have, in the film, a fictionalized gang called the Crowns. Seems they were meant to represent maybe a number of Black gangs and Black organized groups. They were groups who might normally mistrust each other, but whose shared distrust of the police, of government, brought them together. Here's a little sound where Fred Thompson is addressing a meeting, actually, of the Young Patriots.
We oppressed your people for a long time.
I didn't oppress. And my folks grew up poor. They were sharecroppers.
AKA the overseer.
What if the overseer had banded with the slaves and cut the master's throat?
We might not be in this funky ghetto right now.
I bet y'all babies getting the same education. Y'all paying the same taxes to get your heads whooped in by the same pigs. Ain't that a trick?
And of course, it's Fred Hampton, not Fred Thompson. I'm sorry about that. But so there we go. That coalition building is a really interesting dimension of the story.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that Hampton famously said was, we're not going to fight racism with racism, we're going to fight racism with solidarity. And that's the kind of solidarity that he was speaking about, a cross-racial, cross-ethnic solidarity. The Rainbow Coalition that you described is exactly that. And I think it also points to, again, when you look at the history of the party, what became a serious ideological debate within the Black Panther Party as it matured, and that is how much to foreground racial identity and racial pride, and how much to foreground some of the economic dimensions of political struggle and the necessity of cross-racial solidarity as a means to advance the status of working people and poor people globally. I mean, this became a real point of contention as the party matured into the 1970s, and one that many folks said prevented it from living beyond the 1980s when it was ultimately dissolved.
I want to grab a call here from Hannah in Newton. Hannah, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just want to say that I'm a white woman who grew up in Chicago. I was around at that time. It was a very upsetting time to be a teenager. But I grew up in an integrated neighborhood, and we thought the world of the Black Panthers and that they were going to really help transform America. And I was personally just devastated when that happened.
The assassination, you mean?
Yes. Yes.
Hannah, thanks for
that.
Thanks.
Most horrific thing.
Thanks for that call, Hannah. Michael, here was an organization that was making change, that was doing organizing work on the ground, that was working on education, on food, et cetera. What are the parallels to social movements that you see today? And so where are you seeing sort of the building on the legacy of the Black Panthers, who, of course, and I want to acknowledge this again, at least the story that white people have been told since that time is a very different story about the Black Panthers.
No question. I'm going to start with that last point because the caller mentioned she was from Chicago, and the story that was told about the Panthers at the time after the assassination occurred, the way that it was reported in the press was very different from the way that the events actually transpired. It was portrayed almost as a gunfight between the Panthers and the police. And when you learn the history, you understand it really wasn't a gunfight at all. It was an assault by the police on the house where these folks were staying. And that's the way the film portrays it. So the kind of the poor teaching is intentional. It's framed in a certain way. And then you asked about the legacy and the ways that these teachings might continue. I mean, I think we see it first and foremost in some of the ideas in the film and the priorities of the Black Lives Matter movement, the ways that they understand police violence, not as an anomaly of the American condition, but as part and parcel of American politics and the American project of controlling Black bodies and Black labor. This is something that the Black Lives Matter movement has laid bare and made quite clear to all of those who want to seriously engage with it, which is that police violence is not a single issue. This is tied to the entire institutional structure of the country, right? So I think that's one thing. And second thing is some of the lessons about the potential weaknesses of the Black Panther Party, weaknesses with respect to gender politics, which aren't really portrayed in the film, but we know from the testimony of women who were involved in the Black Panther Party that it was not necessarily a great place to be an activist if you were a woman, including Elaine Brown, who ultimately became a chairperson in California, has said things along these lines. I think one of the great contributions of the Black Lives Matter movement is that it pushed gender and sexuality to the forefront of the Black liberation struggle in ways that some of the movements of the mid-20th century really had not.
So with that in mind, what do you hope that today's activists, today's revolutionaries, to borrow the term from Ethan Zuckerman in the last segment, even today's insurrectionists in the way he was using the term, what do you hope they would take away from this film and this story of Fred Hampton and the Black Panthers?
Well, I think it's an interesting case. I mean, the film and the story are two different things, right? The film, I think they're going to see a lot about like the power of charisma, for example, the commitment to solidarity, the unglamorous work of very early activist work where they're sharing apartments and small houses, and there's no political celebrity at the very beginning of Fred Hampton's career, but he rises so quickly, and there's a lot of kind of unglamorous work that goes into that rise. So I think they're gonna take little nuggets from the film, but of course, the history is so much deeper than just the film, and they're gonna have to work in a context that's radically different. But I think the turn toward understanding these problems as global in nature, which was really a key point that the Black Panthers embraced as their organization developed, is something that we've already seen happen with the Black Lives Matter movement. And you look at the images that we saw in Europe, in Asia, in South America, during the Black Lives Matter protest, during the summer when we had 100 consecutive days of protests in Portland, Oregon, and in other cities, you had people filling the streets in places across on the other side of the world, like Germany, for example. So I think the global reach is a lesson that I would hope contemporary activists take from this historical period. And the most important thing is, I think we have to understand that Fred Hampton was 21 years old when he was killed. So it's not really for those of us who are from an older generation to tell younger activists how to carve the path. We have to let them build their own tools and their own practices and trust their leadership and their vision.
All right, that is Michael Jeffries, Dean of Academic Affairs and Professor of American Studies at Wellesley. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.